Hello. In this episode of AS for Architecture, Matthew Fuller and I discuss some ideas from his and Ayle Weissman's 2021 book, Investigative Aesthetics, Conflicts and Commons in the Politics of Truth, published by Verso in 2021.
AS for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to an episode of AS for Architecture. I'm talking today to Matthew Fuller. Professor Matthew Fuller, to talk about a book you published quite recently, Investigative Aesthetics, Conflicts and the Commons in the Politics of Truth, which you wrote with Ayle Weissman. But Matthew, perhaps you could introduce yourself more fully than that.
Yeah, I'm a professor of cultural studies at Goldsmiths in the University of London, and I have a background as an artist, working in digital media, but also working in terms of cultural theory. So a lot of what I do is look at aesthetics in broad terms as it unfolds through media systems, forms of perception, and I'm particularly interested in aesthetics in relationship to questions of experience and forms of knowledge. So the work with Ayle was part of a trajectory of work in a book I wrote on sleep, which looks at the way sleep might be said to have an aesthetic dimension, or how do you have an aesthetics for people that are unconscious. Other work is looking at, in a book, Bleak Joys with Olga Gurionova, is looking at ecological aesthetics, so how aesthetics becomes distributed in natural systems or in technical systems, and produces certain kinds of experience, certain kinds of effect. So this book with Ayle is very much in dialogue with that kind of strand of work, which tries to look at an expanded aesthetics. So thinking mm-hmm. about aesthetics outside of the traditional disciplines that are kind of assigned custodianship of it. So art history, art, architecture, and so on.
That's really interesting, this idea of an expanded aesthetics, because I think for most people, perhaps certainly outside the academy and out of perhaps art practice and critical practice like your own, aesthetics still relates to or corresponds to ideas about the encounter with and appreciation of beauty. Mm. That has been ascended beyond. I mean, where do we stand with it? Where have we come from? Where are we standing with it in terms of your own work?
Well, I think you're right. This is the classical mode of aesthetics from the 18th century, from the work of Jacob Baumgarten and Immanuel mm-hmm. Kant, which describes aesthetics as the kind of disinterested contemplation of beauty. And this is an important tradition. It has it's kind of sustained art in relationship to trying to capture beauty, to set up experiences of beauty, to formulate notions of beauty that can travel through centuries, to allow kind of forms of communication between people. And I think that's been valuable, but I think there is an older tradition. So in a sense that we're going back to a pre-Socratic ancient Greek tradition of aesthetics, which is to do with sensing more broadly. So aesthetics is to do with aesthesis, which is sensing, essentially. And that's where we situate the kind of aesthetics we're interested in investigative aesthetics. So it's very much thinking about what sensing is, what the kind of stakes of sensing are in terms of technologies, in terms of politics, how sensing is related to experience and being able to make claims to truth. So that's part of why we make that move, is that aesthetics is a broader category in this way. So it's not just to do with beauty. And in a way, what we're doing is simply a result of the expansion of artistic practices in the 20th century. So they move beyond the representation or articulation of beauty into something that is about a much broader expansion of the kinds of experience, the kinds of knowledge, the kind of function that art and architecture and design have. So we wanted a theory of aesthetics that could be kind of more adequate to the way in which art and architecture are practiced in the present.
And there's picked up in your book the notion that these more 18th century, 19th century ideas around aesthetics are essentially problematic because they are based on a series of probably Western ideas, but probably upper middle class Western ideas about what is and what isn't beautiful or aesthetic, which has a trajectory towards, I guess, othering and depersoning people in the same sort of way.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think you could describe it in slightly more abstract terms, so that it's not simply about the West or about a particular class formation. That they are based on the idea that it's possible to have a universal aesthetics that is the same for every person. And our claim is that aesthetics is more variegated and more dynamic and more historically dynamic, more dynamic in terms of the range of senses involved, the cultural, political, experiential formations that are involved in articulating and forming subjects that undergo aesthetics. And we're also interested in a wider sense of aesthetics, not simply that it's not universal on the one hand, and that there's a kind of normative end of aesthetics or normative result of that universalization of aesthetics that posits a universal entity that would be the ideal experiencer or formulator of aesthetics. So, you know, whether it's that they happen to be Western or middle class is irrelevant to a certain extent. It's more, although historically that's the case, and one could also say they're male, white, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a general impossibility of formulating any universal as a criteria by which all other acts of sensing might be measured. So it's looking for a radically non-standardized aesthetics in this sense, which means it's more open, more heterogeneous, more dynamic, more riven with different kind of textures and conflicts and so on.
But also that it becomes important in a way again. Like aesthetics has to a certain extent become the branch of philosophy which has fallen away from significance. And by imbuing the aesthetic with a kind of political or social meaning, it's worth encountering again, it's worth addressing again through work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is to make a strong claim for aesthetics as an absolutely foundational mode of knowledge and experience that can engage many other of the different ways in which we categorize or carve up human knowledge, society, life, and so on. So it's to make aesthetics foundational to a wide range of domains, and that's why we think it's important, because the way you sense something, the way you experience something, is the way also it shapes also the way you understand it. So it has epistemic dimensions. It has questions in relationship to politics and power, you know, in the way that if you experience something in a certain way, what it is that you experience, how you experience, how you sense something, what is or is not sensible, and in what way, at what speeds, at what degrees of granularity, and so on, shape what can become sayable, what can become knowable, what's expressible, and so on. And we think this has to be taken into account in terms of how, you know, one describes a relation to the world, whether it's through scientific knowledge, through artistic expression, through the kind of investigative work we're interested in terms of how you shape claims to truth.
In this reading of the aesthetic, in your position on the aesthetic, does this mean that materials themselves say, for example, I don't know, the dust that surrounds Fukushima nuclear power reactor, does that have aesthetic capacity, if that's the right word, out with the experience of the human being encountering it? Does this kind of approach bestow this, what we would see as a higher function, I suppose, a higher cognitive function, on stuff, even when we're not there? So to the question, if a tree falls down in woods and no one hears it, does it make a sound? The answer would be yes.
Yeah, I think there's one way of answering that question would be to put a what's called a panpsychic argument.
I would love to hear one.
Which is different to what we're proposing. So that would be that everything has a certain level of consciousness and has a degree of self-awareness by which it interacts with the world. We're arguing something slightly different in the sense that we argue that everything senses, that everything is in a state of interaction with the world, but its state of interaction with the world is strongly determined by its material composition. So, you know, a brick in a wall is very different to senses the world in a very different way than a human who's inside the building of which that brick is part of. So the brick can experience the wall, it can experience the world, but it experiences the world in a very limited way. But it can experiences the world in a different way than humans do. For instance, when a brick receives a bullet in a conflict, it records that that impact in a very direct kinetic way. It may fracture. It may have a hole through it. It could be turned to dust depending on the caliber of the missile, the impact, and so on. So there's a range of ways in which that brick might crater, it might fracture, it might be pulverized. All of this we see as an aspect of its capacity of sensing the world. And the sensing is very limited. It's not reflexive, but it is part of a complex of material interactions that different kind of organization of matter. So a bird or an insect will have a different kind of sensual capacity than a human, but also different to a brick or a stone or a river, and so on. But each of these material forms will be able to produce some kind of sensual, is absolutely formed by sensual relations to the world. That also means that its pattern of reactions to the world provides certain kinds of trace, certain kinds of evidence, certain kinds of disturbance or record that can be interrogated for investigative means.
You've raised the word investigations. Obviously, the investigative investigative is in the title of the book, and I think perhaps the subtitle conflicts and commons in the politics of truth perhaps relates more to that, superficially at least. What is this? I suppose a position perhaps we might have started with is what is the objective of this book? Obviously, there is a sense that the deployment of aesthetics in the sense of sensing to crises and critical conditions. And Weissman's work looked at the Middle East for Israel quite a bit previously, hasn't it? That we have this kind of opportunity to use our, I suppose, artistic or material culture practices to do action and good. I just wanted to understand a little bit more about the kind of trajectory of this particular book and like where did this particular book come from?
Well, I guess it's come, I mean, Eyal is obviously been engaged with forensic architecture as a project for around 15 years, I think now. It's an attempt, and part of, you know, is a kind of renewal of trying to understand what the kind of foundational knowledge or what the kind of activity that forensic architecture are involved in, but also the wider network of artists and architects that they're connected to. What is the kind of knowledge that they're producing? What are the criteria by which they might assess their work, apart from its kind of instrumental value? So, you know, there are clear successes where the work has, you know, won court cases or has won settlements for people in conflict with the state or with the police, to get settlements out of court. So it's successful at that level. It's able to mobilize audiences and to generate knowledge in the kind of art settings and architecture settings. Then the question is, okay, what is the more kind of methodological, what is layer, what is its epistemic framework? How does it produce knowledge? So this was the question of the book, in a sense, is really how can we come to terms with what it is we're claiming? How do we systematize that? How do we think about the shift of architecture and the expansion of architecture as an aesthetic practice, not simply as something that makes buildings, but also as a way of thinking and as a way of viewing the world, and of viewing with great degrees of expertise and acuity relations between material entities in the world, and how things, spatial objects, unfold over time. How can that be turned into a way of looking at political situations or things that are often understood in human rights terms? So the killing of a journalist, for instance. How can architectural skills be used to understand how an event like that unfolds over time? Mm-hmm. So obviously with architecture, you have a whole range of highly attuned sets of skills around space and around ways of modeling space, ways of constructing space, measuring it, of using spatial forms to understand other forms of record, and of constructing, for instance, a classic thing we look at in forensic architecture's work is the use of three-dimensional models to embed photographic and video evidence, ballistic evidence, satellite imagery, and so on. And to use the 3D model as a way of grounding that evidence, but also testing it and providing a framework in which that evidence can be brought together to see which pieces of evidence work together, which evidence contradict each other, what can be said to be probably true, what can be said to be definitely not true, what can be said to be an actual fact. And so we look at how architectural skills can be used in a context outside of building, but of understanding space more generally and of what happens in space, and of using it to measure and to fine-tune different claims to truth and bring them into some kind of relation of compossibility.
Very fascinating idea. And I like this, particularly like this idea of the kind of composition. It's almost like the work has some kind of genealogy that goes back to, I don't know, collage making. It's or bricolage maybe. It's got a kind of very interesting, almost as you know, and it sort of explains your presence within this as an artist and as an expert within cultural studies, that there is something creative in this process. Is that a fair assumption? Is this a creative process, or is it more, because you've talked about the methodological imperative of sort of establishing the hows, and I'm always interested in methodology. Probably the thing that interests me most about research is actually how it's done more than anything else. I probably lose attention before I get to conclusions, that's the problem.
Mm.
But I'm just very interested in this idea of what's the heritage of this kind of methodology? Where does it come from? And is it collage? Is it a creative practice?
I think it's creative in the sense that it finds new uses for existing well-established and well-honed skill sets.
Mm-hmm.
It's also that, so that's one layer of creation. I think there's another layer of creation in which it kind of reimagines forms of argumentation. So if the work, a lot of kind of political debate or legal debate is carried out in text or in language, in spoken language in a courtroom, or in written language in articles or books, what it does is think about how can you make a very clear argument about what did or did not happen at a certain point in time in a certain space through forms of architectural reasoning. So it's about how to compose an argument within using architectural tools in the work of forensic architecture that we're particularly interested in. And so this has a question, this sets up a question of what is the relationship to truth? What is, how do you go about finding facts? How do you go about dismissing things that claim to be truths? What are the mechanisms for evaluation? And spatial reasoning, temporal reasoning, what can or cannot exist in the same space and time, can often be also not simply creative, but also quite maddeningly rationalistic, in the sense that you're trying to find the most precise description of an event, but also find the most precise description of the limits to the knowledge you have about that event, based around the resources that are available in terms of what maps are available, what video footage, what sound recordings, what kind of GPS data, mobile phone data, and so on, can be brought together within one model in order to try and make an account of what is there at the same time.
I'm really interested in this notion of the truth or post-truth. Just as an aside, I think, does this mark the end of the postmodern period? This kind of moment that we've got to, where there's this reappraisal, I mean, restatement everywhere, all the time, that there is such a thing as truth, which is a remarkable turn of events. I mean, basically post-2016, post-Trump, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you have to be cautious about such a claim.
Never knowingly cautious, by the way.
So I think I would say we're interested in fact, which is different to truth, and I think there is the question of truth is what you try to arrive at, and facts are means by which you get to that. And even before you get to facts, you have to get to the forms by which facts are represented. So you have to, try and triangulate, so that these means by which facts are represented might be, mobile phone video footage of an event. It might be someone's verbal transcription. It might be body cam footage from a police officer. It might be, satellite imagery, before and after image. It might be expert analysis of a crater produced by a missile or some other kind of explosion. So you need to find ways of looking at those entities, whether they're technical descriptions or they're mediatic descriptions of something, and try and find ways of triangulating them and using them to test each other to find out which makes the best description of what it is you're trying to understand, what it is you're trying to describe. And that's something that's about representation in a way. So, if the art world has, say, 200 years of testing representation, it makes it, through the many, many different art historical waves of different approaches to painting or photography or different styles or technical constructs that allow for an engagement with a portrait, a landscape, an experience. All of those give us a kind of set of resources that we can also use to analyze the technical, which is often described, you know, which is often used in order to account for a particular historical event, a murder, a human rights violation, a state crime, an act of pollution, of deforestation, and so on. So, but all of these have to be taken cautiously and in terms that recognize their capacity for sensing. So what the specific technical structure is of an image, what its degree of granularity is, how sensitive it is to certain kinds of light under certain kind of lighting conditions, and so on, that allow for a more kind of humble approach to the establishment of facts, which, you know, then requires collaboration with multiple other kinds of fact proposing or fact determining devices. So what we're interested in this book is this things like spatial models produced by architects in forensic architecture allow for multiple candidate facts to be assembled and tested together. And we're interested also then in, you know, what we call the investigative commons, which is wider processes of elaborating alliances with different kinds of knowledge, witnesses, victims of violence, social groups, political campaigns, scientific knowledge, technical knowledge, of finding ways of bringing those together so that stronger claims to fact, which can then also get at truth in certain ways, can be set up, can be articulated.
Yeah, I was thinking as you were talking just then and earlier about this idea of these architectural tools, I suppose, as you call them, that where do they derive from? Because I think for young students and even practitioners of architecture's tools are fairly limited. They're a device for representing the fronts of buildings. And sometimes the plan. What are we talking about when we're talking about tools here? You've talked about the spatial dimensions of things, and obviously the role of technology is becoming more and more paramount. Are we talking here about non-standard tools or stuff that is common to the practice of architecture itself?
Well, in a sense, architecture is always in dialogue with, although not reducible to, geometry. And, you know, so the tools that are built around the basic understanding of the world in geometric terms, like three-dimensional modeling tools, CAD, mm-hmm. game engines, all of these can be useful in assembling models of the world, which then the world can be measured against, tested against, and so on.
It sort of imbues, it takes back, I mean, one of the things that I've noticed over the years of my doing architecture, so I started studying architecture in that horrific period at the beginning of the New Labour government where it was about making the most idiotic shape humanly possible for a lot of money. And we've moved into a period where the ethics of architecture have become paramount, not least in relation to issues around environmental sustainability, ecology, but also in relation to things like crises of cash. Like, people aren't very rich anymore, or a lot of people. Some people are really rich. Other people aren't. And I think that this idea of then redeploying the language and the logics of architecture towards an ethically just end is obviously relates to that. And I think that's really beautiful. And this idea of a kind of activist practice. I was just wondering, in relation to that, I don't know the art world hugely well, but I assume that just as architecture was disappearing up its own arse in the late part of the 20th century, art was perhaps finding itself down the same cul-de-sac and has found through instruments like yours, through forensic architectural type approaches, a way of resituating itself at the center of cultural discourse, of becoming more important than perhaps in the late 20th century it had become, where it was decorative, essentially. Is that part of the objective? Is the objective to make the art world relevant?
I think not to make the art world relevant, but more to say that art is very heterogeneous. There is no singular art world now, in the way that you might be able to say up to the, let's say, 1980s, you might have been able to say there was a kind of consistent art world. Maybe even that is too generous. Maybe, you know, we're looking at, say, 1960s. I think there are many different art worlds, and they have many different logics and many different kinds of degrees of attention to certain aspects of what art might be. But I think art is in a state of expansion and of unfolding in many different directions. And I think that's why there are many different kinds of argument abroad at the moment about, you know, what is or is not art, what is inside and what is outside. So there's we're for a very kind of open and expansive definition of what art is, but there are also much there are many who also have, you know, a much more traditionalist approach that art is to do with questions of the gestation of feeling, the understanding and representation of beauty, and so on, which, you know, is certainly part of it, but we think that art has changed through multiple different trajectories. You know, the demand and the forceful entry of women, of non-white artists, of black artists, and so on, into art history in a way that just cannot be ignored. Also institutional changes to art schools, which, you know, develop different ideas of art as a form of research, that also changes the nature of art. Then you have, let's say, what were hitherto kind of marginal art practices, such as media arts or digital arts, that also change forms of emphases, change kinds of expertise, change ways in which art is spoken about, in order to reconstitute the terrain of what art is. And part of this can be, you know, run through the history of art in the 20th century, from the avant-garde, in which, you know, art was everything. Art could change your entire way of life, your politics, your mode of eating, your mode of being in the world, to, you know, the conceptual art, which, you know, looked at non-traditional forms of expressing philosophical approaches to matter, to the world, to the constitution of ideas, to the kind of so-called post-media phase in art, in which art was no longer limited to performance or to video or to sculpture or to painting, but that art was something that was much more expansive, and artists would work across media or work in in ways that weren't pre-established through different forms of action in the world. So we see that the art more generally is becoming a much more open field, which is not to say that there aren't highly traditional, highly conservative forms of operation within the art world. There are clearly many of those, and in order to stabilize the art world as something that can furnish billionaires with objects worth millions of pounds, certain, you know, highly powerful means of stabilization have to be in occurrence, which can run through institutional forms of criticism, forms of art production, forms of education, forms of market, and so on. So we're also, you know, we have to be cognizant that that's happening, but art itself as a much wider field is, you know, is connected to that in complex ways. But it's something much bigger than simply, you know, production of a certain class of financial asset.
How has the digital, so you've mentioned digital art, for example, as something that has expanded the field. And before we were recorded, you mentioned you were vivering, if such a word exists, vivering a PhD on games production, for example. How has the digital field impacted and inflected the work of forensic architecture? Is forensic architecture and this sort of investigation dependent upon the digital? Is your work, is this book, the fruit, perhaps, of the digital turn?
It's possible. I think you could have an investigative aesthetics that was purely analog, but it would take very different forms. I think there are examples of artists carrying out work before computers became a kind of primary seat of culture. Think of someone like Hans Hacker and his 1972 work, Schapolsky et al., a real-time social system, in which he deploys, a photo image type conceptual art in order to map a system of property ownership. So what he does is go to an area of Manhattan, take photographs of the building facades, and then lists the owners of those of the separate properties within those buildings, and then makes a separate network diagram of relations between those property owners. So it shows that many of them are shell companies for a particular company, and shows the pattern of ownership within these sets of streets, which happen to be primarily slums, and looks at who's legally owning them and who is the ultimate owner and benefactor of the revenue derived from them. So it's something done in entirely analog terms, but it's something that mixes conceptual art strategies of mixing photography and text with more investigative practices, looking at company ownership. So classic investigative journalist activities. So that would be an example of a non-computational investigative aesthetics. For forensic architecture, a lot of their work is something is based around computational activities, and so making three-dimensional models and then bringing together material sourced from social media, from smartphone videos, from satellite footage, from many other sources of data into those models, creating timelines, creating composite images which allow for the assessment of the data. So this is fundamentally computational. I would say another layer would be the importance of machine learning in the present. So when you're trying to understand what happened in a certain city on a certain day, there might be, in order to find out whether there's any data available around a certain event, you need to triage sometimes tens of thousands of hours of social media footage in order to catch a glimpse of an explosion cloud or the movement of a tank or the presence of a person, and so on. So you need to use machine learning in order to detect the presence of these entities within the available video or photo footage. So the computational layers are multiple and of many kinds. And that brings with it its own question of aesthetics. What is the aesthetic of a file format or of a video format in making certain kinds of things sensible and making other things less easy to gain traction on?
I was thinking about the way in towards the conclusion of the book, you talk about the idea of the commons, again, the investigative commons, which you've mentioned already, this kind of coalescing of fragments of knowledges, in a very kind of pluralist manner. And the digital seems to me to be the space in which that commons is most amenable. It's almost as if in the context of being a modern person, we are or have been and have found a space in which common experience can be shared. And that kind of liveliness that I suppose perhaps romantically characterizes our image of the commons can be realized once again. Whereas in fact, urban space and the material environment we live in has become less and less able to actually do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be possible to design cities and to live cities as commons. I think there are definite decisions that have been made to make urban spaces in the present less inhabitable. And I think, you know, there could be many other forms that, that cities and property relations and the politics of cities could take. But I think there is also this sense in which, even though we live in increasingly privatized realities, those the capacity of making societies, the capacity of making life requires collaboration, requires commons, requires labor. If we think of, you know, the amazing revelation that was found during COVID, that societies relied on care workers, relied on delivery workers, relied on very basic, badly rewarded forms of labor that are absolutely fundamental to contemporary society. This kind of revelation could form the basis for a new kind of commons, that is a kind of collective valuation of the work that is done that produces the possibility for society. And we can say that, you know, forms of privatization and forms of the turning inwards of social forms rely absolutely fundamentally on mutual aid, on care, on collective labor. And perhaps it's time also to, you know, find ways in which that can be expressed in terms of the built environment in different ways. And what we think is that this foundational capacity of people to collaborate is something that can also be elaborated in terms of coming together to produce political arguments, of producing knowledge about events. And this requires, yeah, a collective, non-hierarchical approach, which can gather together and work with different forms of knowledge and different forms of experience, always recognizing that, you know, those most impacted by an event, whether it's a state crime, whether it's a police murder, whether it's an environmental catastrophe, those most impacted are usually the people with the most important things to say and the most in-depth knowledge of what's happened. Mm-hmm. And that knowledge may be heavily conditioned by trauma. It may be, you know, conditioned by other, you know, forms of social violence, of inhibition, of threat, of violence, and so on. But that absolute kind of foundational knowledge that is had needs to be incorporated in any investigative practice for it to be to really get access to strong claims to truth.
Does this investigative aesthetic that you describe, which is largely deployed, as I understand it, in conditions of crises, that is, of violence rather than, say, for example, inequalities of power, does it have the potential? And I think, judging by what you've just said, it possibly does, to describe conditions of perhaps more subtle disempowerment, structural violence, spatial injustice. Is the methodology that you articulate, this aesthetic investigation, investigative process, is it something that has broader application to understand, for example, the way that Sheffield City Centre no longer seems to be kind of commons as we understood it, but has become a privatized space?
Yeah, I think the work of forensic architecture has been often around specific events, you know, things that happen within a few seconds or a few minutes, maybe unfold over a few hours, like a particular military event, a particular kinetic event, let's say. And these are geometry is a very useful way of understanding those. And, you know, if architecture is partly the means for unpacking and experimenting with geometrical forms of knowledge, which is a very narrow definition of architecture, but it's one that might be useful in this context. You can also say that this could be unfolded into longer spheres of time. So a lot of what forensic architecture have done is to think about how very small points of time, so half a second, for instance, is folded into much larger scales of time. So, for instance, when you have the killing of someone on the street by a police officer who claims that they're acting in self-defense, what is it that makes that officer feel that their defense requires, or their response requires a violent action? So for instance, there's a case in which a Chicago police officer shoots dead an unarmed man because the police officer claimed that he thought he was armed. What is it that makes that officer think that the best explanation for someone's movement, the movement of someone's arm, is that they're about to go for a gun or that they have a gun in their hand? In this case, forensic architecture's argument is that the work of creating that split second decision is the result of centuries of cultural formation, of political formation that produce subjects that are trained to behave and believe in certain ways. So reactions that take a split second may take centuries to accumulate. And it's about unpacking the relations between the very specific event and the wider formations that produce it, that happens in those kind of cases. Now, in terms of how a spatial formation like Sheffield City Centre, which could be unpacked in different ways, could be investigated. I think it would be interesting to think, okay, what would be required to make that kind of claim? What are the determining movements and changes to the space, the mode by which people inhabited it? What would be the determining factors? How would you analyze them? How would you gain access to records of them that would give you certain kinds of evidence, or certain, each with a certain kind of propensity to make claims of truth and certain kinds of difficulty in making claims to truth? So that's would be more of a kind of methodological perspective, and thinking what are the preconditions to be able to make the kind of claim you're looking for. And I say, certainly that could be possible, but it would need a different kind of methodological assemblage, and a different assemblage of people, equipment, materials, modes of knowledge, forms of assembly that would allow that to be done.
Thank you very much, Matthew. I think that's a great point to finish on.
Great, thanks very much.
And so it goes. Thank you to Matthew for taking the time, and to Verso for the book. Links to it and to Professor Fuller are in the podcast description. Thanks for listening.